Okay, this morning is going to be synergy galore because essentially we are directly taking off from our parashas here on Thursday with a pasuk that was the last pasuk in that third aliyah that we focused on. But the topic, in addition to expanding on that discussion and connecting to some of the larger themes, is a general halachic topic as well, which happens to have halachic relevance and also philosophical relevance to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and the like. So we'll try to explore as much as we can. There's a lot to say about it. We'll see if we can get everything done today. We'll also have to figure out the rest of our choppy week, how much we can get in, but that's essentially the goal. And it happens to also connect to Maseches Bava Basra in the larger sense, so we're going to do as much as we can to synergize from all the different perspectives. So the last pasuk in Shlishi that we started with on Thursday was Hanistaros L'Hashem Elokeinu V'Haniglos Lanu L'Vaneinu. And the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin on Daf Mem Gimel Amud Beis, if you have a chance to see, has a comment there which is in line with Rashi on the Parsha, Rashi in Chumash, that what's going on there, that it's actually a dispute in the Gemara in Sanhedrin how exactly to understand it, but that what the Pasuk is referring to is the interconnectedness of the Jewish people. That having come in the context of all of the responsibility and all of the consequences for our behavior and everything that we actually saw specifically highlighted in that third aliyah. So in that context, the Torah tells us that that which is hidden, so only God knows about that. That which is in terms of people's minds and motivations and intentions and inner behavior that is not known to the public, so that's between the individual and God. But haniglos, that which is out there in public, that lanu uvaneinu adalam, that's for all of us together. And at least according to one opinion of the Gemara, there is a distinction being drawn between the two types, but the public behavior, that's something for which we all share responsibility. And apparently this is also specifically said in the context of our projected entry into the land of Eretz Yisrael, that there, that is going to bind us, that is going to create one joint entity, and therefore, we now are responsible for each other. We now have this notion of Kol Yisrael Areivim Zelazeh. So this is one of the sources for that idea, for this kind of interpersonal responsibility, which has implications on many different levels, has broad philosophical implications, and also has apparently some specific detailed halachic applications. So certainly as a phrase, it's one that we've probably heard all our lives, we're all responsible for each other, and it carries a certain message of unity of Klal Yisrael. This was a theme we already saw in the Aliyah a few times. That's a part of what's going on. But among the very specific halachic connotations that it has is a din, which is relevant to Rosh Hashanah, and relevant to every Shabbos, and relevant to a lot of ritual behavior. And that is, it's a detail in the laws of Shemaya Ka'ona. That we know that there is such a concept that we can perform a verbal audio mitzvah on behalf of someone else, and they can fulfill that mitzvah through us. So we know we can fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush by listening to someone else. We can fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyas HaMegillah by listening to someone else. Shofar is similar. Shofar is a part of this discussion. It's a little complicated what exactly are the mechanics for shofar. That really requires a lot more explanation. But for now, let's put it in a similar category, that the mitzvah of shofar, which is relevant to all of us, at least to all men, it's the mitzvah seisha azman grama, so technically women are exempt, although women generally volunteer to perform mitzvah of shofar also. So the mitzvah of shofar is fulfilled through usually one person in the shul blowing the shofar and everyone else listening. Whether that's similar to Shamei Ka'ona or some other kind of mechanism would require us to go into much more detail about shofar, but for now, let's assume it's a similar kind of idea. So, in that process, whether it's shofar or kiddush or megillah, if you want to fulfill the mitzvah by listening to somebody else, the person who is doing the generating of the sound, blowing the shofar, or making kiddush, that person has to be obligated in the mitzvah. Has to be what we call a mechuyav bedavar. So the question becomes, so how is it then? So we know, let's say Rosh Hashanah, so often there are people who aren't able to make it to shul, whether they're not feeling well, they're sick, or unfortunately the current matzav, you have people in quarantine perhaps, or contagious, whatever it is, people who are unable to come to shul. And very often somebody else will come after davening's over and blow shofar on their behalf. So how does that work in light of what we just said? Right? In light of this rule that you have to be obligated in order to fulfill the mitzvah on behalf of someone else. So if you already went to shul, you're not obligated to blow shofar again. Or a similar dynamic happens on Purim. Somebody who goes to shul in the morning and then goes to the hospital or wherever in the afternoon and reads the Megillah for people, so he's not obligated to hear Megillah a second time. So how does this fit the rule of requiring a mechuyav bedavar in order to be motzi someone else? So here, the Gemara Maseches Rosh Hashanah explains it, and Daf Chav Tes Amud Aleph, that the Gemara tells us a rule that kol ha-mitzvahs kulon, af al pi sheyotza motzi, that even though one has already fulfilled the mitzvah, he's nonetheless able to be motzi someone else. So it's apparently addressing this question, right? That even though we require the one performing the mitzvah to be mechuyev, we don't consider him unmechuyev because he's done it already. As long as he's somebody who's technically obligated. So we'll use the example of shofar. So we mentioned before, women are technically putter from shofar. They're not even obligated midrabanan. The obligation is a voluntary one. The act is a voluntary one because of mitzvah saseh shazman grama. So many women do volunteer to perform the mitzvah, but they are exempt. So therefore, you couldn't have a woman blow a shofar on behalf of the shul because she's pater. So all the men who are obligated, it's not going to work for them because they are neither in need of a mitzvah from somebody who's mechuyav b'davar. Which has all kinds of interesting implications as far as shofar is concerned. And again, it's a different discussion. Halavai, we could cover everything. But you need to be obligated. So the person who already fulfilled his mitzvah shofar, let's say he went to shul with all the hidurim, everything, deraisa, derabanan, all the brisker, chumras, everything, every possible scenario, he for sure fulfilled the mitzvah of shofar. So to go and to blow shofar again, so why is he able to do this? Because that's this rule, hafal pishi yatsa motzi, that does not cancel out his status as mechuyav bedavar, the fact that he heard the shofar before. So Rashi explains, and the Ran, a number of the Rishonim understand, that this is because of this rule of Arvis. Kol Yisrael arevim zabazah, zalazah, different kirsol, zabazah, zalazah. So therefore, essentially what it sounds like is that keeps my chiyuv alive. That you can't tell me that just because I heard the shofar already, that I have left the concept of obligation in shofar. Because if you still need to hear shofar, so that keeps my chiyuv alive. So this is a fascinating concept, and there's a lot to explore, and we'll just mention some of the ideas today because there really is so much to say, but it has both practical implications, lumdish implications, hashkafic implications. There's a lot that is tied in here. And it's particularly interesting also as far as one of the themes that we've been talking about recently. So here's a synergy coming at you from a couple of levels. So we're learning Baba Basra this year, And our last Bavasra share was about Minig, and we spoke about how presumably there's a difference between Minig and Mamonos and Minig and other areas of Halacha, but there's also room to see connections between them. So here there's something similar, that there is a concept of Arev, which is the sugya of Bava Basra. It's actually one of the last sugyas in Bava Basra, Halavai, if we're zochet to cover the entire Masechta this year, from the very beginning to the very end. So the very last sugya, Kufayin Hei, Kufayin Vav, and Bava Basra, is that same word, Arev. And there, it's in a monetary context, and it's a concept that exists in secular law as well, but as we'll see a little bit, it's coming from a completely different background. But the concept exists that in secular law you have a notion of a cosigner or a guarantor. So if somebody borrows money and the lender is not 100% confident in the borrower and wouldn't necessarily be ready to provide the loan just on his knowledge of the borrower, so somebody else who has more credit, more credibility, he can come and co-sign, guarantee for the loan, and that will encourage the lender to provide the loan. So that concept exists in halacha, and it's binding, meaning that the lender can collect from the arev, from the guarantor, if the borrower himself defaults. The different kinds of arev, let's assume the simplest sense that if the borrower is not able to pay, or not ready to pay, so then the lender can collect from the arev. So here you have the same word. Are they related concepts? Do they come from the same place? So that mamonos principle and this din in hilchos mitzvos and hilchos brachos, are they related? So what would you say to that? It's just language, or they have any connection? Your thoughts, Zach?
Well, if you think about the concept, they really are connected. It's I'm the guarantor for my fellow Jews' mitzvah, that Hashem says, I don't know if you're going to do the mitzvah or not. So I have, however many Jews there are on earth here to help you out. So it's a very similar concept in my own.
Okay, so that's you actually focusing on a detail I wouldn't have necessarily thought to bring in, but it's interesting. You're saying that specifically the fact that God, so to speak, conditioned the giving of the Torah on this, that we are all going to take responsibility for each other, which is a fascinating aspect of it to explore. I wasn't actually thinking of that details per se, but it'd be very interesting to think about where that takes you. But if you had a chance to see this morning, the Ritva at least makes the explicit connection, right? The Ritva in Rosh Hashanah on that daf, on daf Chavtas, he says that the reason we can fulfill mitzvos on behalf of others, even when we're not technically ourselves still obligated to do it, meaning that we don't have it on our to-do list in that sense, because it's already done for today. But the idea that the Gemara says, Afal Pisha Yotza Motzi, so the Ritva says, because we're all areivim for each other, just like a lender and a borrower situation, explicitly mentions that connection as linking the two. So the language is not just there as a coincidence, but the language is meaningful. The concept, at least the way the Ritva is portraying it, is that they actually are the same idea. Now, I would love if we do have the opportunity to talk about the sugya of Arev in Bava Basra, because it's a fascinating sugya for so many reasons. But a part of it, and this just goes also to the theme that we're talking about the unity and the integrity of halacha and how different areas are reflecting on each other, even though they seem to be in completely different areas. So if you learn that sugya, you'll see that one of the makoros for Arev in loans is from a completely different kind of context. Really super, super fascinating. It's not from a loan of a monetary context, but the source that the Gemara brings in is a pasuk in Sefer Bereishis. It's about Yehuda accepting responsibility for Binyamin when they go down to Mitzrayim to go meet with who they don't know is Yosef, and Yaakov was not going to want to let his remaining son from Rachel go down, and Reuven tries to convince him unsuccessfully, and Yehuda is more successful in convincing Yaakov to let Binyamin go. And the Pasuk says, Anochi Arbenu, that I will take on responsibility for him, and then it's referred to again later when he's talking to Yosef, and he says, Ki Avdocha Aravis Anar, you have that same phrase there as well. So the Gemara refers to that as a mucker for this concept of a guarantor, of a cosigner. So it is all linked, you know, these very seemingly different ideas of interpersonal responsibility are apparently all connected at their foundation. And here the Ritva has this din, that has the statement that the concept of arvus that explains why you can fulfill a mitzvah on somebody else's behalf, even if you've already done it, is connected to the Mamonas idea. So that's a very, very fascinating linkage, and hopefully we'll have opportunities to explore that a little bit further. So this idea, the Gemara there draws a distinction, which you have to work to understand a little bit, just trying to give you a little bit of a overview of the idea here. So the Gemara has a distinction between mitzvos and the brachos that are associated with mitzvos, and berachos hananim. That when it comes to a bracha on food, so then I could theoretically make a bracha on your behalf if we're both eating food, if we're both going to have a piece of cake, so I can make the mizonos and you can listen to my mizonos and fulfill the bracha that way. But what if I don't need to make a mizonos right now? Say I'm not eating, or I already made a mizonos before, so can I make another one on your behalf? So that, the Gemara says, is a problem. There's a distinction drawn between Birchus HaMitzvos and Birchus HaNenin. And the Ritva explains that a little bit also in the next comment, if you had a chance to see, that that doesn't rise to the same level of Chiyuv. That the whole premise is that because you are obligated, so therefore that keeps my obligation alive. But what if I don't have an obligation? So, or you don't have an obligation, so you don't need to be eating this. So, therefore, you don't need to make the bracha. You're choosing to. You're deciding that you want to. So, therefore, that doesn't create a chiyuv that is upon me. Hi.
He does mention the possibility of once you have already eaten, I could be yotze you in birchas amazon because now it's a question of you fulfilling your chiyuv.
Correct. Right. But here, if I'm trying to help you with a chiyuv that you don't have to do, so then that doesn't create a chiyuv in the same way. Now, still, one could question it, and there are some essays written about this topic also, that, okay, but the maisa, once you're deciding to eat it, so then it does create a chiyuv, so why should that be any different? And the Gemara also raises the question, which the Ritva talks about also in more detail, are there some brachas that are hybrids, that are technically Berchas Hananin, but they are obligatory because of mitzvah reasons. So the two examples would be, and those who were with us last year might recall, we spoke about this a little bit at the end of the year, not so long ago, in the context of Kiddush, so the Bari Pri Hagafen, that is there for Kiddush purposes. So maybe that takes on a different kind of status. Rishonim explained it in slightly different ways. But maybe that takes on a different kind of status. That should be considered like a berachas hamitzvah, at least enough to enter into this category. Or similarly, matzah on Pesach night. So there you're making a hamotzi lachem and haaretz on it. It's a berachas hananin in its format. But there's a chiyuv to be eating it. So maybe that should be treated a little bit differently. So that's also a discussion how exactly to understand the nature of this chiyuv. There was a big machlokas, which also, you'll recall if you were here last year, we spoke about this in some detail, that the Dagom Ravava raised the issue. The Dagom Ravava was written by the author of the Noda Behuda, one of the great Gedolim of the 1700s, and in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch, which is called Dagom Ravava, so he raised the problem that if you go to shul Friday night, so according to the Magen Avraham, you are in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Kiddush on a level Menat Torah. Now that's assuming, even if they don't make Kiddush in shul Friday night. That's for simplicity's sake. Let's say the Kiddush is not recited in shul publicly ala kos, But they daven Ma'ariv with a reference to Shabbos, so maybe that's a fulfillment of Zachar Sum of Shabbos Lekadsho. It's a fulfillment of the Mitzvah Menat Torah of Kiddush. So if that's the case, Dalgam Rav Lava says, well, then we have a problem, because if you really are in fulfillment of the Mitzvah of Kiddush on a level Menat Torah, so okay, you're not done. You still have a Mitzvah Derabbanan to go home and to make Kiddush B'Makom Suda Al HaKos, you still need to do that. But maybe it's a problem for the man who goes to shul to go home and do this on behalf of his family, including his wife. Because the Gemara says in Brachos and Daf Chaf Mitbeis that women are obligated in Kiddush to the same degree as men are, exactly on the same level, Lashon Chayavos B'Kiddush Dvar Torah, because there's a drasha on the Pasuk, Zachar and Shamar, an unusual kind of drasha, and therefore women are obligated in Kiddush in the same way. So if that's the case, so then she's obligated, your wife is obligated in Kiddush Menat Torah, and you went to shul and you davened, you're only obligated in Kiddush Midrabban. So how can the man come and make Kiddush on behalf of his wife? She is more obligated than he is. It doesn't satisfy the standard of being Mechuyiv B'davar on a satisfactory level. So that's a question which a number of Sfarim deal with, and they address the premises. Is it really true that you're Yotzei in Shul? Is it possible that you can decide not to be Yotzei in Shul? Are there other strategies that can be employed? But on the simple level, the answer is, well, why does the whole question get off the ground? That we have this concept of Arvus. That's what we've been talking about. And so that somebody who already fulfilled the mitzvah is nonetheless able to fulfill the mitzvah on behalf of someone else. So that apparently should be the answer. That should be enough, that the man has this concept of arvus, which allows him to fulfill the mitzvah on his wife's behalf. So why is that not satisfactory to the Nodu Behuda, to the Dogram Rav Abba? So his question was really premised on an additional point, that the Rush, if you got a chance to see it, put it on the Makoros this morning, the Rush over there in Brachos, it sounds like he's saying that Arvus does not apply to women, which is Chiddush. You have to figure out why that should be. And it prompts many other issues. So, for example, the Prima Gaudim discusses when it comes to Megillah, so there is an assumption, la halacha, maybe we'll have an opportunity to explain this more at Purim time, but there's an assumption, la halacha, that women are obligated in Kriyas and Megillah in a different way than men are. So therefore, women can't read for the tzibur, that includes men, because they're obligated in a different way. But presumably, many assume that women can read for other women, that they're obligated on the same level, so a woman can read Megillah for others. That's a dispute if that's 100% true, but that's how many assume. So some raise the question, well, what if this woman already heard the Megillah? So can she still read on behalf of other women? Or does the principle of Arva still apply? Or what about this Rush that sounds like there is no such concept? So there's a lot of literature about this. Some of it goes to Parshas Nitzavim, trying to figure out the context of the source for Arvus. Is there room to distinguish? Is there room to interpret the Psukim in a way that explains it? But Pashtus is, it would seem, that the Rebbe Kiva Eger is correct about this. The Rebbe Kiva Eger, in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch over there, Reish Ayin Aleph, which also stands for Rebbe Kiva Eger, so it's easy to remember. But Rebbe Kiva Eger over there, he responds to the Dalgam Rav Abba, and he explains and seemingly points out that that's not what the Rush seems to be saying. That what the Rush was apparently saying is not that women are excluded from Arvus, because indeed that would be difficult to understand. Why should that be? It's hard to understand logically, based on what we've seen about Arvus, why there should be any such distinctions. So rather, he is explaining the issue in the Gemara over there. That the Gemara over there, Brachos and Daf Chaf, The Gemara wants to know, are women obligated in Berachos HaMazon min HaTorah or not? We know that women are obligated midrabanan, at least, in benching. The question is, are they obligated min HaTorah as well? So the Gemara there asks, well, what difference does it make? Which is itself an interesting question for the Gemara to ask there, but the Gemara says, why does it matter? They have to bench anyway. So whether it's Darais or Darabanan, does it really make a difference whether we call it one or the other? So the Gemara says, yeah, it matters, because what if she wants to bench on behalf of her husband? So if her husband fulfilled if he's obligated in the mitzvah of benching, min ha-Torah, if he ate a full meal, so he fulfilled the standard of v'achalta v'savato v'erachta, or v'achalta v'savato, so now he's up to v'erachta, that he ate enough to be full, so he is obligated in benching min ha-Torah. And if his wife is only obligated in benching midrabanan, so then she's not going to be able to be motzi. So question is, that there the Gemara seems to be saying that her rabbinic obligation would not be enough to fulfill a obligation that's been a Torah of her husband. So as the Rush notes, it sounds differently from a Gemara later in Maseches Brachos, and Daf Mem Ches. There is a story of Yanai HaMelech, who was looking for somebody to bench at a meal that he had. He called over Shimon ben Shatach, who hadn't eaten anything, so they told him to eat the kazayas. So if you eat a kazayas, so you're obligated in benching midrabanan, but not necessarily min ha-Torah. So there, the Rush explains that yes, but the concept of arvus is what allows him to bench on behalf of that whole group. That even though they're obligated more than he is, but because of arvus, he is able to bench on their behalf. And that's the difference between his situation and the question the Gemara is asking about women and her husband. Okay, so far so good. Everyone following? So it sounds like the Rush is distinguishing. Arvus works for Shimon ben Shatach, but it doesn't work for the woman who's being discussed on Daf Chaf Amud Beis. So that's what leads these Acharonim to say, oh, apparently there's no arvus for women. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger explains that, no, the difference is that in order for arvus to work, you have to be obligated in the same mitzvah. So Rav Shimon ben Shatach is theoretically obligated in Berachos HaMazon and HaTorah. So even if right now he isn't, because he only ate a kazayas, so still the arvus is going to allow him to bench on behalf of these people who are obligated. Now, parenthetically, say, okay, so then why do you have to eat anything? Why do you even have to have a kazayas? Let him have nothing. So he needs to have a kazayas so that his bracha is meaningful. But the fact that the level is different is not going to be a problem because of arvus. But if women aren't obligated in the mitzvah itself on a level of min ha-Torah, so then it's going to be hard to say that they have a principle of arvus to use, especially when they're going to be the one, in that case, to be generating the bracha. It's hard to say that arvus is going to allow her to bench on behalf of her husband if she's not obligated in the mitzvah itself on a level of min ha-Torah. But when it comes to Kiddush, so there the Gemara says that they're obligated equally. So if they're obligated equally, then there's no reason why arvus shouldn't connect them. So in other words, as Rabbi Akiva Eiger is explaining, the Rush never meant to say that there's any categorical exclusion of women from arvus. It means that we have to look at every mitzvah and see who's obligated in this mitzvah. Whoever is obligated, they're all connected through the principle of arvus. But if there's a fundamental difference in the obligation, which might be true by benching and is not true by Kiddush, so then that's where you could have an issue. So everyone following so far is a little complicated. Make sense? So this is a topic of a lot of discussions, a lot of literature about this. It seems that the premise of the Noda Bihuda here is that Arvus is more of a general concept, that it applies to people categorically, and that the idea of Arvus is that you accept a responsibility for the other, and vice versa, maybe vice versa. While it sounds like what Rabbi Akiva Eiger is saying is that Arvus is a detail of every mitzvah, that every mitzvah has an obligation to perform the mitzvah and also a responsibility to others who are obligated to the mitzvah. So it all comes together. And we look at every mitzvah and we see if there is such an obligation. So that's an interesting concept. It's similar to, you know, we nowadays, so we daven Ma'ariv generally, but we don't have Chazar Sashatz. So why do we not have Chazar Sashatz for Ma'ariv? So the Rambam connects it to Tfilos Arvus Rishos. So the question is, so what? So, all right, so Tfilos Arvus was voluntary, but why should that affect the question of Chazar Sashatz? So some explain, I think Rav Shach explained this way, that the whole point of Chazar Sashatz is Lahotzi Esheino Baki, that originally the institution was, they put an extra Shmon Esrei there out loud so that if somebody didn't know how to daven, so then, especially in the days when they didn't have printed Sidurim, so the Shliach Tzibur would daven on behalf of those people. So that is true if there's a chiyuv to daven, so then we'll have this concept that the Shliach Tzibur, who already davened his own private Shmon Esrei, he can now say another Shmon Esrei on behalf of those who have the chiyuv to daven. But if Tfilos Arvus is a Rishus, if it's voluntary in the first place, so then you're not going to have any justification to say another Shmon Esrei, because how could you say Arvus is what's generating it when that means you're responsible for other people's obligations? And here there's no obligation. They don't know how to daven Ma'ariv, it would seem they're not obligated to daven Ma'ariv. So that could perhaps explain why Tfilos Arvus Rishus connects to this idea. Now it's interesting also on that same Gemara about Rav Shimon ben Shetach and Yana HaMelech and Brachos and Daf Mem Ches. So the Tzlach over there has another comment about Arvus, where he says that Arvus doesn't apply to Dinim Derabbanan. Now what's interesting is who wrote the Tzlach? The Tzlach was written by No, it's different. It's Sadi Lamed Ches.
Oh, of course.
So they got the Lamed in the middle.
The
Noda Bihuda, right? The same Noda Bihuda we were just talking about. So it's known for three Svarim. So he wrote the Tshuvas Noda Bihuda, and he wrote the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Dagmar Rebava, and his commentary on the Gemara is called the Tzlach Tziyun LeNefesh Chaya. So the same Noda Bihuda, I guess in the contemporary political climate, you'd call him, I'd say he's like against Arvus rights, because he is limiting Arvus in a couple places. So here is his commentary on Shulchan Aruch. He has this limited understanding that it doesn't apply to women. And in his commentary to Maseches Brachos, he's saying here that it doesn't apply to mitzvahs d'Rabban. Now, the problem is you have to figure that out both source-wise and logically. So logically, why should it be? Why should there be a distinction? Why should we say that it should apply not to Derabbanan? It should apply to Deraisas, not to Derabbanan. Any thought, any suggestion why? Yeah?
Because Deraisas, we were on the Kappa at Sinai, so it was
an okay, so it could go back to that, right? It could go back that if we're assuming that this is the Mucker, these Psukim that we've been reading, so then, okay, what was there at the time was a part of the acceptance, and what comes later is not necessarily included. So some point out that this might be especially true according to the Rambam. Actually, splits off in both directions according to the Rambam, but if you focus on one source in the Rambam, then it might be especially true, because I gave you a look at this morning, that the Rambam Hilchos Malveh Ulova, in talking about the monetary Arvus, So there, the Rambam says that in order to accept Arvus, you have to know what you're accepting. You can't just say, I accept to guarantee this person's loan, and you have no idea how much it is. It could be some tremendous amount, some unlimited amount. So according to the Rambam, Arvus does not work in that sense, the monetary Arvus. Some other Rishonim disagree, as Kest Mishnah notes, the Reb Migash, the Meiri, others have a different view. But it sounds like from the Rambam that you can't accept Arvus for something that is not defined at the moment. So if we assume that there is a link between monetary Arvus and mitzvah Arvus, they're operating on the same principle, so then that could be what's going on here as well. That if it wasn't there at Sinai, so it's not fair to say that we all accepted Arvus. Hi.
Could this go back to like the difference between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Gamliel?
Okay, so again, remembering that it's the same author, so it'll
yeah, I'm saying yeah, yeah, because you know, Rabbi Yehuda says it's about status or categorically.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning you can't like Chazal can make you obligated, but they can't create like a new status of clear for you.
Okay.
They don't change your nature. They change what you maybe need to do.
Right, so that's what we talked about, a little bit about Dim Drabbanan. So yeah, it could connect, and that's the question is whether if there's no Chiyuv Gavra, to get into the, we'll have to probably explain this in a little more detail, but if we say that Dim Drabbanan do not create a Chiyuv on the individual, so then maybe you need a Chiyuv on the individual in order for there to be Arvus. Now, let's consider the other side for a second. So why would we assume, as there's much reason to assume, we'll see in a second, that Arvus should apply to Drabbanans? Yeah?
We accept upon ourselves at our Sinai to follow all the Drabbanans.
Right, so that would seem to be perhaps more compelling, right? That we do assume, especially one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, is Los Aser. So if that's the case, and we saw that, as we mentioned, we had both directions for the Rambam. The Rambam is the one who says that Lo Sasser is going to include all future Dinim Drabbanan.
But he contradicts himself.
Well, maybe. That's the question. We could use him for both directions. He doesn't explicitly contradict himself. The question is what we want to do with each source. Because basically we could bring him as a support for either position. Because if we want to say that Arvus includes Dinim Drabbanan, so then, like I was saying, that it seems like you could explain it based on his view, that Lo Sasser includes everything that is yet to come. But if we want to explain why it shouldn't work, so we could point to his comment in Hilchos Malva Velova, that if we're using the model of monetary Arvus, so there you have to know what you're getting into. So he's not explicitly contradicting himself, because he isn't taking side one way or another, but we could use him for conflicting sides. We could decide which Rambam to focus on and use him as proof for one perspective or the other.
So then how would the side that I guess feels that there is our voice Derabbanan read this Rambam? Would we just say it just applies in monetary cases and nowhere else?
Yeah, or you'd have to say that this is not Katsuv, that you know that you would basically agree that you're going, it's not Eino Katsuv, that you're basically agreeing to deal with whatever Chazal say. And that's more controlled than it sounds like. You know, that's not infinite. You know, it's not saying that, okay, he can just borrow any amount of money and I'm signing off. He's saying that there is a, which is something itself very interesting to explore. Now, what also gives you a little bit of a blank check with the Rambam is that the din of Yatza Motzi that we started with, the Gemara says that you can be Motzi somebody else even if you were ready in fulfillment of the mitzvah. So we said that Rashi and the Ran and the Ritva explain that because of Arvus. But the Rambam, Mishnah Torah, doesn't say that. Rambam just says the Din of Yatza Motzi doesn't connect it to Arvus. So that gives us still more latitude to interpret the Rambam in different directions, because he doesn't necessarily, you could say that maybe he doesn't believe in Arvus by the Rabbanans, and the fact that the Gemara says Yatza Motzi, maybe that's a different Din. Maybe that is somehow a condition in these mitzvos, but it's not necessarily because of Arvus. Because on the surface, part of the difficulty against the position of the Noda Behuda is that you have a number of examples which do seem to involve Dinim D'Rabbanan. So first of all, the Gemara is applying it to brachos. Brachos themselves are, for the most part, Dinim D'Rabbanan. So in order to explain that, you'd have to say that against the Rishonim who explicitly connect Arabis there, and you'd have to say that it's from some other din. And we also, at least in practice, we apply it to other Dinim D'Rabbanan. So, for example, we apply it for Megillah. So we certainly assume that it applies at least for that Dinim D'Rabbanan. And there are other examples. Just to mention, just the time was mentioned one or two other points. And maybe we'll find opportunities to come back to this because there's so much to say. We just need to get as much in as we can. But the we use it perhaps also for Sfiras HaOmer. At least there are those who raise the discussion. So just to mention a few interesting applications of Arvus in the opposite way, just to mention two or three. So, for example, let's say Kiddush, so we see that that's a situation where we apply Arvus, that somebody who was Yotze can still be Motzi somebody else. But it also works backwards, because if we do make Kiddush and Shul Friday night, so why do we do that? So the Gemara says that in the Talmudic times, they used to make Kiddush and Shul Friday night, because even though normally you have to have Kiddush B'Makom Suda, you need to be in the place where the meal is, but there were people who were visiting who were eating in the shul. But still, the one who was making Kiddush on their behalf was not eating in the shul. He was going to go home. So he was now Yotze Kiddush himself, because he has to go home and have his Suda there. So he's making Kiddush on behalf of people who will be Yotze, while he himself will not be Yotze. So it's coming in the opposite direction. Not that he already was Yotze and he's being Motzi other people, but he's pre-Yotze, because he's going to, he doesn't have Makom Suda here. But he's somebody who's technically Chayiv in Kiddush, so therefore he can be Motzi people who are not, who are obligated fully, who are going to be Yotze with that, he can be Yotze them because of Arvus. So that opens up the door in other directions. And just to mention one or two other examples, so the Gemara in the very beginning of Maseches Megillah, the first Mishnah Megillah, talks about a special license that was given to the farmers who provided the food for a celebration of Purim. So the Mishnah says that there are three categories of when the Megillah is read. So the walled cities, everyone else besides the walled cities reads on the 14th of Adar. And the walled cities, they read on the 15th of Adar, Shushan Purim. And there was an extra category, the farmers who needed some extra latitude. So they were given room to do earlier so that they could do it on a Monday or a Thursday whenever they went into the big city. So whatever it took to get it to a Monday or a Thursday, they could do it earlier. So the Rishonim try to figure out what in the world is going on there. So apparently they need to have it done in the big city or on the market day. Why? Why can't they just do it any day of the week? So some of the Rishonim assume that apparently they didn't know how to read the Megillah. So in their village, they wouldn't be able to fulfill the Megillah on their own. So they had to coordinated a time when they were going into the big city. So then what happens? So then the people in the big city read for them? So how does that work? So let's say on the 13th of Adar, they went into the big city. So the city people are not obligated on the 13th. So they're not mechuyev. So how can they read on behalf of these visitors who were given license to read on that day, but the person reading is not obligated? So the Rishonim have a whole Dean about this, not a simple question for a couple of reasons. But some suggest that Arvus works that way too. That because this person is technically obligated in Megillah, and on the 14th he's going to be obligated, so Arvus will work backwards to let him read on behalf of the people who have a special dispensation to read earlier. Again, a very fascinating application. So some bring this up in the category of one of the rabbi's worst nightmares. Do you think it's hard to be a rabbi? So what's the one of the hardest things that could happen? That the rabbi has to be especially careful not to miss a day of Sfiras HaOmer. Because if he publicly makes the bracha and counts sphere in the shul every night, it's going to be very awkward if he misses a night and he's out of the count. So, as you could expect, such a nightmare situation. So there's a lot of literature about that. Is there any etzah for the rabbi to still be able to count sphere with a bracha in public, in shul, if he is not himself still counting with a bracha? So there's a couple of angles to consider for that question. But one of the suggestions is that if we assume he is doing it on behalf of the shul, because there might be people in the shul who need him to count sphere on their behalf for whatever reason, so then he can still be motzi then. Because he's not an einu mechuyav b'davar. He's obligated in the mitzvah of sphira. It's just that he's unable to fulfill it because he missed a day, and however that impacts on the mitzvah, it stops him from carrying out his mitzvah. But he's not released, he's not putter from sphira, he's obligated theoretically in sphira, he just is unable to fulfill it. So since he's technically mechuyav b'davar, and there are people who may need him to fulfill on their behalf, so therefore he can read, he can recite the mitzvira with a bracha in order to be motzi those people midin arvos.
Not only if he knew there were people.
So that's a good question. You know, the whole thing is a little bit of a stretch to begin with. It's one of a couple of ideas that are thrown in there in order to explain how it happens. And there's a lot to analyze in general, the whole minig of having the rabbi or anybody publicly count sphere, and then gets complicated why the people who listen make a bracha afterwards, because if they're listening to his bracha, it could be the yotzei from that angle. So there's a lot to analyze about what exactly is going on there. So the whole suggestion is a little bit of extra sniff and a little bit of that. So it's a good question whether he has to actually know, or if we work off that premise that he's doing this in general on behalf of whoever might be there, who might need it. So therefore, that could keep him in the game. Question about that?
Yeah, just is it possible that like counting might be like a little bit more active than like saying a bracha? It seems to be like, even though they're both verbal, mm-hmm. they might be like they seem different.
So therefore, what? So you're saying that?
Therefore, it would make sense that like the rep, like it would be better for the person to say himself.
Oh, so that's actually another interesting discussion that it's not so obvious to everyone that Shemei Koner works for Sphira. And there might be some argument to be made along those lines. But here, there's two things at stake. One, is he performing Sphira on behalf of the shul? Or, on top of that, maybe they're still able to perform Sphira on their own, but he's reciting the bracha on their behalf. So there's two different things under discussion of the Sphira, which the Taket is what to wonder about, and the bracha on Sphira, which also has its own set of problems. Okay, so far so good. So there's a lot more to say about this, and maybe we'll return to some of these issues, but it's also interesting to note that it has these applications, and it also has broader applications. There are some who suggest that the mitzvah of tochacha is connected to arvus, the idea that you have to rebuke others who are on the mistaken path in any particular issue. Others argue that they are not related, that they are distinct. And the Tshuva's Beis Yitzchok, he understands that this is also behind the discussion in the beginning of Maseches Shabbos, that there the Gemara has a discussion, do we ever say, Chatei kidei sheyizkeh chavercha, that you should sin so that your friend should be better off, and your friend should be saved from a sin. So that opens up all kinds of different angles. The specific case the Gemara is talking about is, let's say somebody put bread in the oven on Shabbos to bake. And if it gets to the end stage, so then the individual is going to be chayiv misa really or chayiv a korban b'shogeg if he allows the chil Shabbos to finish. So the Gemara has a discussion there. First of all, can that person himself take it out of the oven? Because there's an issa d'rabbanan of taking bread out of the oven the way it was done in those days. So the Gemara wants to know, can this individual perform this issa d'rabbanan to save himself from finishing an issa d'raisa? And in that context, the Gemara asks, can somebody else do it? Can somebody else violate this drabbanan to save the first guy from a iser daraisa? So do we say chatei kidei sheyizke chavercha? So what exactly is the logic there? There's a lot to talk about, and Rav Shechter Shlita has an essay about this in one of his svarim. It's a whole discussion of what exactly is the mechanics behind the premise of chatei sheyizke. And there are some who understand that it's a function of arvus, that because we are all interconnected, so therefore that creates a possibility, at least, that I could undertake a avera on the behalf of somebody else. So it's interesting, especially if you say that tochacha is a different din. So to say that this still is connected to arvus is interesting, because you see it is more fundamental than tocha. Tocha is about, okay, I'm obligated to worry about you and to stop you. But here we're saying it's more than that. I'm mamish in there with you. So if you are in trouble right now, so then I also have to get my hands dirty, or at least I could get my hands dirty in order to save you from the avera. So the level of interconnection that is suggested by this idea of chatei kidei sheyizke is a very profound statement of connection. And perhaps that's also the other half of this din of brachos, that as long as you still need to fulfill the mitzvah, so then my chiyuv is still there. It's clearly different, but it's kept alive by the fact that your obligation hasn't been fulfilled.
Would this also connect, like, I mean, going back to, I guess, Purim a little bit, like, of the idea, like, let's say, Avera Lishma, like, you know, I, Queen Esther, can marry Ahasuerus,
yes,
for the greater good of the whole Jewish people.
It does connect, especially if you look at Rosh Hashanah, I think it's in Vikve Hatzom, so he does assume the sugyas are related. You know, the whole concept of Avera Lishma and Chetei Kidei Sheyizke and things like that. So he has an essay there where he does, there's a lot to say about that. Maybe we'll have opportunity to go into that in a little more detail, but he does assume that there is a connection between those concepts. There's a lot to consider about that. So we see, and maybe we'll find time to talk about this more, so this has relevance to the details of Rosh Hashanah and Hilchos Shofar and the like. But it also has relevance to the whole essence of Rosh Hashanah. So you recall, especially within the context of our third Aliyah shiur, so we started off by noting that we read Nitzavim alone yesterday, and Tosfos, again, Bava Basra, Synergy points to that as well, Bava Basra Pechasim Ubeis, that Tosfos says that the opinion of Rav Nissim Gaon was that we read Nitzavim by itself in such an unusual way of allotting the parshios. Those 40 psukim separated in its own parsha, because we want to get Nitzavim in before Rosh Hashanah to create a buffer between the klalos of Kisavo and the new year. And we mentioned the explanation that it's not enough just to have the klalos in the previous year, but we need the buffer of Nitzavim as a affirmative step of Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kolchem, that we are all standing here together. And that achdus is what changes the course of things. So especially if we understand that from this aliyah, the idea of arvus that connects us all, so to emphasize that and to appreciate that going into Rosh Hashanah is itself such a crucial concept for approaching the new year and for hoping to change course and to fulfill that bracha of the Nisim Gaon's position. He quotes the Tosfos of Tech Lashana Vekil Alseh, that all the problems of the past year should be undone, should be relegated to the past. So this notion of Achdus is very much front and center. And as we've also commented, which is the nature of a lot of the klalos of the past 2 years has been this whole pandemic situation. And as we've mentioned in the context of Bava Basra also, that if anything, it reminds us the extent to which we are interconnected and that we don't have the ability to just say we're in this on our own. So to whatever extent, it's an appropriate kapara for that, appropriate kapara for something which had to remind us that we're all as one. So this notion of taking on this sense of interresponsibility, specifically before Rosh Hashanah and in this season, is one that is very powerful. Now, this may also explain one other major detail in the halachos of Asar Simei Tshuva. So maybe the next time we meet, when it will be, God willing, in the middle of the Asar Simei Tshuva, maybe we'll find time to explore that a little bit. So that next time we meet is Thursday. Som Gedalia is itself got its own schedule, so it's also Thursday, so we can have a little bit of Parsha Shir and a little bit of Asar Simei Tshuva, so maybe we can come back to that. But just to quickly say, that to quickly recap, we spoke about this din of Arvas, Kleshol Rebim Zelazeb. We talked about how it has connections in the broader sense, hashkafic connections, but a very specific halachic application that you can recite, you can perform a mitzvah on behalf of somebody else, even if you're already yotzei. It doesn't mean you're not mechuyev b'davar, and that's how the din of yotzamotzi is explained by Rashi and Duran. And we talked about various nafkaminas about that, and we talked about the possibility that it is connected to the din of arvus by mammon, above a basra topic. And we saw some fascinating implications of that. We talked about whether it was a categorical status, the whole discussion with Nodav Yehuda and Ricky Vager about women and the like. And we talked about whether it applies to Dinah Drabanan and how the Rambam's words can give us basis to say in either direction, and that in the context of Yatzimotzi, he also leaves it open, so could be he understands it either way. And we talked about some of its broader applications, also possibly in the context of Tochacha, possibly also in the context of Chadei Kedei Sheyizke, and that how, especially within our Parsha Shir and Parsha's Nitzavim, it's especially relevant to approaching Rosh Hashanah and the idea of Achdus before the Yom HaDin, and the goal of Tech L'Shanah V'Kilaseh, that's so much front and center in our concerns right now. So with all that, it should give us a very strong foundation to enter into Rosh Hashanah. So I look forward to seeing you all next year. Bez Hashem on Thursday, we'll figure out our format and our context, but we will take that a little bit further. Everyone should have a Shana Tova, should be a year of Bracha, a year of Mazel, a year of Techa, Shana Kilosah, and look forward to seeing you soon.